Hello, folks, and welcome to another edition of The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My name is Grant Podolko. I'm an editor at referl.org, and I'll be your host this week. On this week's show, Don DeLillo, author of the critically acclaimed novels Libra and Underworld, talks about the role of the writer in free and in unfree societies.
It takes enormous courage to write against the state when you know the state is your enemy.
In an exclusive interview, Iraq's foreign minister, Hashyar Zebari, justifies the Iraqi military's deadly raid on Camp Ashraf, run by members of Iran's banned People's Mujahideen organization.
No country in the world will tolerate any organization to undermine its sovereignty, to defy its authority, and to act as if this is a liberated territory or a state within a state.
And we spend some time with Aliya Sabirova, a woman who has devoted herself to preserving and promoting the language and culture of the Russian Republic of Tatarstan.
Aliya is a sensitive person. Life can be cruel and difficult for sensitive people, but Aliya is a genuine Tatar woman with a sensitive artistic soul.
But first, to Afghanistan. In the days of the Taliban, agents from the infamous Ministry of Vice and Virtue patrolled the streets, on the lookout for violations of the militia's strict moral code: illegal music, kite flying, too short beards, too much skin. Now, a draft law being discussed in post-Taliban Afghanistan threatens to bring the morality patrols back. Mustafa Sarwar, a correspondent with Radio Free Afghanistan, has the story.
A proposed law that wants Afghans to observe Sharia standards of modest dress at weddings is causing outrage in Kabul. Some say it sounds like the Taliban is returning.
How do you dress up is a personal matter. I think interfering in such personal issues is like interference into people's family life. I'm against monitoring weddings. It is inadmissible to interfere into either the personal or family affairs of people.
That's Abdul Sameh Safi, a young law graduate of Kabul University. At first glance, the new law might not seem so threatening. The Justice Ministry wants to control weddings because they have become so big and expensive that few Afghans can really afford them anymore. To get married, people have to go deep into debt, and that the Justice Ministry says harms family life. That the weddings have gotten big and showy in Afghanistan, no one can dispute. All across the country, there are giant commercial wedding halls which can seat as many as 1,200 people and cost thousands of dollars to rent for an evening. This is in a country where the average annual income is less than $400. What the wedding palaces offer is a public place where the guests can enjoy the kind of freedom that traditionally people only enjoyed in the privacy of homes. The freedom includes wearing Hollywood-style wedding dresses that sometimes show bare shoulders or low necklines, and it can include dancing on both the men's and ladies' sides of the partitioned hall, plus some visiting between the two sides. Given the size and costs of such weddings, some hosts might welcome the ministry's proposal to limit the scale. The proposal, which is now being considered by President Hamid Karzai's cabinet, calls for restricting the number of guests to 300 and spending no more than about $5 per guest. But the fact that the Justice Ministry wants to include representatives of the Religious Affairs Ministry on the committees that would police weddings makes people wonder if law's real purpose is more far-reaching. Habiba Donish is a young Afghan member of parliament who opposes the proposed legislation. She sees it as an effort by hardline mullahs to reassert some of the powers they have lost in the post-Taliban era.
I personally won't vote for this because the mullahs will take advantage of it.
For many people, the proposed law recalls the way the Taliban used to police weddings to ensure they observed the hardline militia's ban on music and dancing, both of which is considered against Sharia. Some critics of the Justice Ministry's proposed new law even wonder if perhaps it's a gesture by officials to reach out to the Taliban as the government tries to bring the militia into peace talks. Siad Anwari, a young activist, puts it this way.
I think the government is bringing up this issue for a political purpose, to make the Taliban happy as well as to show that it is taking the initiative to trying to safeguard family budgets.
The proposal does not spell out exactly what Sharia standards would be applied, but it bans wedding shops, for example, from selling, in the proposal's words, outfits that are semi-naked, naked, transparent, or tight in a way that reveals part of the women's body. It's not yet clear when the cabinet will take up consideration of the proposed law, or if it does, whether it would be approved.
That was Mustafa Sarwar reporting. Correspondent Charles Recknagel also helped out on that story. For more than four decades, Don DeLillo has been exploring the subliminal, the ironic, and the strange in America's collective subconscious. His novels, among them Underworld, Libra, Mao II, and Falling Man, have dealt with themes of fear, paranoia, and secrecy. Brian Whitmore recently sat down with DeLillo, who was in the Czech capital for the Prague Writers' Festival. DeLillo discussed the controversy over Libra, his fictional portrayal of the JFK assassination, from the point of view of Lee Harvey Oswald. He also addressed the role of the writer in free and non-free societies.
When you publish Libra, the conservative columnist George Will called it an act of literary vandalism and bad citizenship. Your response was priceless. You said that writers should be bad citizens.
Yes, writers should be bad citizens. Writers in general, I'm not speaking about individuals, of course. Each individual chooses his or her own route. But I think it's helpful in a culture such as ours, that is American culture, that writers at some level write against the thrust, the commercial thrust of the time, the overwhelming glut of consumerism, the political drift of a government and of the people. And one needn't write specific political fiction to do this. It's just the idea of being in opposition, the writer in opposition.
Now, that's in our society. Now, in some of the countries we broadcast to, former Soviet Union, the Middle East, Central Asia, and what have you, writers are quite literally considered bad citizens.
Yes.
Persecuted.
Yes.
Could you expand your statement? And you've spoken very eloquently over the years about this in the context of Western consumerist society. What about in a society like Iran or Russia or Belarus, where the writer is really risking his or her life by being a bad citizen?
I think almost every day of how lucky I am to be writing in a free society, a society in which free expression exists. And I'm a member of American Pen, and occasionally there is an event in which we do what we can to support writers who are imprisoned or at least threatened by their governments. And in some cases, not necessarily the governments. Mexican journalists are harassed and killed for their work. So it's something I never forget. What about these writers? How do they survive? How can they do it? It takes enormous courage to write against the state when you know the state is your enemy. And, you know, it's the writer's ideal condition to sit alone in a room doing his work. But what happens when the state locks the door of the room and he can't get out? that's what happens in China and in many other countries.
Can writers still affect the inner life of these cultures?
Of those cultures, I think they can. They would certainly have a chance to bring about change more than a writer in a free society, where everything is consumed, where writers are consumed with breakfast cereal. But in order to bring about this change, they may be risking not only their freedom, but even their lives.
So the payoff is higher, but the risk is also higher.
Yes.
That was Brian Whitmore talking with author Don DeLillo. The full interview with DeLillo can be found on our website at referl.org.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast.
On April 8th, the Iraqi military launched a raid on Camp Ashraf, 60 kilometers north of Baghdad. The camp is the headquarters of the People's Mujahideen of Iran, an organization opposed to the current government of Iran. According to the United Nations, some 34 people were killed in that raid. On a recent visit to Radio Free Europe's Prague headquarters, Iraqi Foreign Minister Hashyar Zebari talked about the controversial raid, the fate of the divided city of Kirkuk, and the uprising sweeping the Arab world. Eugene Tomiuk has the story.
Iraq's foreign minister says a military raid that the United Nations has killed 34 people was aimed at taking back land from the control of Iranian exiles. In an exclusive interview, Hoshyar Zebari told Radio Free Europe that Camp Ashraf is prohibited by the Iraqi constitution. Some 3,500 Iranians currently live in the camp, which is run by the members of Iran's banned People's Mujahideen organization, which seeks to overthrow Iran's clerical leaders. Zebari said the raid by Iraqi military forces was necessary because the camp's presence in Iraq is unacceptable.
This was a military operation intended to take control of part of the territory. Ashraf camp is not a small camp. It's 50 kilometers large. And the Iraqi military extended its authority over about 20 such kilometers of the camp. And no country in the world will tolerate any organization to undermine its sovereignty, to defy its authority, and to act as if this is a liberated territory or a state within a state.
Zebari called the deaths unfortunate, but denied that the aim of the raid was to send camp members back to Iran. He said Iraq has asked for support from European governments to help resettle camp inhabitants. Zebari also said the fate of the disputed northern city of Kirkuk could be decided soon. Three ethnic groups, Arabs, Kurds, and Turkomans, dispute who should control the divided city. Baghdad and the Kurdish regional government are negotiating over Kirkuk's vast oil resources, which could be enough to give Kurdistan the ability to make a move for autonomy. Zebari said the issue is a constitutional matter.
There are procedures to address, resolve these issues. And the government, the new government, it was voted into power to implement constitutional article 140 that right. calls for the normalization of the situation in Kirkuk and other disputed territories. So it's an obligation on this government.
Zebari also addressed the spreading uprisings across the Arab world. Pro-democracy protesters have already ousted the leaders of Egypt and Tunisia and are agitating for change in Libya, Bahrain, Syria, and Yemen. He said Iraq can serve as a model of sorts for people who want their voices heard and their governments to follow the path of democracy.
I think what the people of these Arab countries are calling for basic rights, basic democratic rights, basic freedoms, representative government, elections, being part of the decision-making. Iraq has done this through the hard way, through a difficult, arduous route to building democracy. it hasn't been easy with the foreign occupation, with the sectarian war, with the terrorisms, with the regional interventions, but Iraq has passed the test.
The full interview with Iraqi Foreign Minister Hashyar Zebari, which was conducted by correspondent Joseph Hammond, can be found on our website at rferl.org.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنید.
Машал радіо Дамінія
Аура. ДТМ.
Радіо Ава.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Tatar Language Day was celebrated this week in Russia's Republic of Tatarstan. The language and culture of the republic are under constant assault from outside influences, including Russia and the West. Nonetheless, many Tatars cling to the anchor and identity that their ancient culture provides them. Correspondent Alsu Kumasheva visited one Kazan journalist and mother who has devoted herself to the future of her native tongue.
By day, Aliya Sabirova wraps her arm around her three-year-old daughter, Sofia, and shares a good book. By night, she is in the spotlight, belting out Latin fusion-influenced songs to crowds of dancing teens in a Kazan nightclub. Her eyes shine and she sings and sways to the rhythms of her native Tatar language. The 35-year-old Sabirova is thoughtful and soft-spoken, but she harbors an artist's passion and devotion to the timeless culture of Tatarstan and a determination that it remains alive and growing despite the pressures of global influences from Russia, Asia, and the West. Together with her husband, a graphic designer, Sabirova is a leading figure with the NGO Uzibis for Ourselves. The group is decidedly non-political, more likely to call youth to a poetry slam than a hunger strike. Sabirova and her friends at Uzibis were busy with preparations for a gala concert and a festival on April 26, the birthday of Kabdulla Tokay, a turn of the 20th century poet, critic and a publisher who is considered the father of the modern Tatar literary language. That date has become Tatar Language Day, and Tokay's classic poem, O My Mother Tongue, is the Republic's unofficial anthem. Sabirova, though, describes herself as a realist, not seeking to force the culture and language on anyone, but rather force of example and by creating opportunity to make them vivid, engaging, and modern.
The only way to keep Tatars from losing their identity is culture. There is no point in talking about political independence right now, but we can create our own cultural independence. Tatar culture is very different from Russian culture, so we promote it and bring young people into what we are doing.
Also, Ismailova is a fellow journalist and a close friend of Sabirova's. She admires her friend's sincere commitment to her culture and her art.
Aliya is a sensitive person. Life can be cruel and difficult for sensitive people, but Aliya is a genuine Tatar woman with a sensitive artistic soul. Everything she does sincerely. That's why she is a successful person.
Tatar is spoken by more than 7 million people in Russia, Ukraine, Central Asia, Poland, China, Finland, and Turkey. It is a Turkic language that has been influenced over the centuries by Arabic, Persian, and Russian. Although its use declined in the Soviet period, and Tatar language education at all levels has long been a highly contentious topic, ethnic Tatars cling to it proudly. In the 2002 Russian census, 94% of those who identified themselves as ethnic Tatars claimed to speak the language. Sabirova studied Tatar philology at Kazan State University and then followed opportunity to Moscow. But she never felt at home in the Russian capital and after a few years brought her family back to Kazan. She sees now how her own children are subject to the pull and push of outside cultures. Her son Bulat is 15 and her daughter Alfia is 13. Blood avidly consumes Japanese anime art, while Alfia dreams of becoming a painter. Both are deeply immersed in Russia-dominated culture. When it came to their education, Sabirova had to make some hard choices. She sent them to a Russian school.
Parents must decide for their children, either to send them to a Tatar school with reduced prospects for the future or to a Russian school which will give them more opportunities after graduation.
Although there has been Tatar language primary and secondary education in Tatarstan since shortly after the breakup of the Soviet Union, children who graduate from them cannot continue with their high education in Tatar. The final exam of the Russian educational system is given only in Russian, and there are no universities offering full-time study in Tatar. Art, poetry, music, these are the tools that Sabirova and the activists of Uzebes are using to pull Kazan's youth into their native culture. Sabirova's own salsa and rumba rhythm, backing Tatar lyrics, are gaining popularity in the clubs. Likewise, popular Tatar language rappers like Shakur are demonstrating the fresh vitality of an ancient language. Tatar is no longer considered an endangered language, but it faces stiff challenges. Sabirova's youngest daughter, 3-year-old Sofia, feels the gravitational pull of the Disney princesses and other outside influences. And Sabirova has no desire to prevent her children from getting the most of what the entire world has to offer. You can't make your children speak Tatar just because they are Tatar, Sabirova says. But if you give them a good song with a good beat, you might be able to make them want to sing it.
Tatar Bashkir service correspondent BK Timurova and correspondent Robert Coulson contributed to that report. Yuraklar orta, sabablar turlidir. Qoshiqda hodis so'z qo'rqinch sirlidir. Qoshiqda g'aybatning og'uli inasi, hislarga yomon shir. And that's all the time we have for this week.
For uncensored news and music, millions of East Europeans switch on Radio Free Europe, the in sound from outside.
If you've got a question or a comment about this podcast, we'd love to hear from you. Write to podcast@referl.org or leave a message on the Blender blog at referl.org. This is Grant Padalko. As always, thanks for turning on the Blender. Take care, everybody.